Welcome to PCMC, Pop Culture Man Children. I'm Mike Bongiorno. I'm joining my good friend, Mr. Peter Marsh. What's your middle name? Your middle name?
I have two, Robert Charles.
RK. That sounds like a good, like, Peter RK Marsh. That sounds like a good author name.
Charles with a C.
Okay.
Yes. P.R. Marsh is the author name.
Robert Charles. Why did I say K? There's no just think it's Charles with a K.
We RC just got like this energy going right now. We're just like full throttle into this, man. You know,
it's about catching ideas. Catching ideas. So Peter is the co-host of The Lassercast.
The Lassercast.
Podcast on YouTube and other places about horror, and sort of dark sci-fi stuff, and then also comic books Transform, which I've been on both of those shows as well. And
the true highlight when you're on those shows, by the way.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Yeah.
Today we are talking about David Lynch's Masterclass. So. Yeah. For anyone who doesn't know what Masterclass is, right? It's basically a streaming, when you take away the bullshit, it's stream. It's a streamer. Can you buy them one at a time, or you just buy subscriptions? I remember having a subscription.
You have to buy a subscription, and it's for a year. It's not like a month, 5 months. Yeah.
Yes. All right. So I don't know how, it's like a Ponzi scheme. I don't know who the first person was they got to do it. But the more people they got to do it, the more real people did it. Yeah. And basically they get somebody who is a leader in their industry to sit down and talk for like 8 hours. And they kind of edit that into what they call a class. It's kind of like if, you know, they were a guest lecturer at a university. And they even take some of what they say and they make it into like a PDF that you could download. So they could really lean into the idea of like, this is a class. Mm-hmm. And some of them have like, some of them are more classes than others. Like some of them have exercises and stuff. David mm-hmm. Lynch's does not. David Lynch's is really just like a very long interview, but he really gives his all. He seems very dedicated to doing it. He seems happy to be there. And what's, I'll say, cute about what they do is they try to make it David Lynch-y. Like they have like weird cuts and like weird sounds, and they try as much as they can in, you know, Masterclass to try to ape some of David Lynch's actual style. Peter, mm-hmm. when did you first see this?
I saw this in the middle of COVID. I sort of went on a David Lynch kick. I'd always loved Dune when I was a kid, his version of Dune, and I'd seen Blue Velvet. I thought Blue Velvet was really good. I'd seen it when I was like, I don't know, 20 years younger. Then for whatever reason, I think because I was just on Twitter all the time, people were always talking about David Lynch. People in the horror community yeah. were really into David Lynch.
Sure,
so
yeah.
I saw that he had a masterclass right when I was getting into him. And also, just because I was getting into him, I got his book, Room to Dream.
Ah, yes. And, I've read that.
Yeah, and this masterclass has a lot of content from Room to Dream.
Yes. Yeah, what's interesting is, like, people have, there's a sort of belief about David Lynch, which is that he's very enigmatic. And, you know, if you ask him, you know, what was the ear in Blue Velvet? Or what was the point of the green glove in Twin Peaks The Return? Or why is Bob whatever? He will not answer, right? He'll say, it's up to interpretation. It's not for me to tell you. He really believes in sort of a post-structural idea about media. He really believes that you're making the meaning as the reader of it. But that being said, he is very open about talking about the process mm-hmm. of making things. He won't talk about the content. He won't talk about why he makes any decisions he does. But he'll talk about how he lives his life. Which I think mm-hmm. is the most interesting stuff here. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I think this. He'll talk about how he lives his life and how he does his work. Mm-hmm. But in an interesting way, and we'll get into this. He has a way of seeing creativity as almost external, not something that comes from within, but comes from outside.
Yep.
And this particular masterclass, I think more than some others, has really like it gets chopped up into TikToks and Reels a lot. I mean, now it's available in full on YouTube, and no one's ever taken it down. It seems like this masterclass, more than any other masterclass, has transcended the little like box of masterclass and be just come some just like what 2 hour and 40 minute document that is
Right.
very precious to people. And you know, I'm not a filmmaker, and I wanted to be a filmmaker when I was a kid, but I'm not a filmmaker now. I don't want to be a filmmaker now. So the stuff that works the least for me is when he gets super specific. But when he's just talking about big idea life, I find it fascinating.
Yeah, I 1000% agree. As someone that loves David Lynch, it's a treat, right? But as someone who's trying to learn about filmmaking, I don't know how valuable it actually is, right? Like you were talking about how David Lynch is during interviews, right? And I'm trying not to do the David Lynch voice. I'm going to try not to do it, even though I will easily bust into it at
Oh,
any
so will
point.
I. It's so hard to
Yeah.
not.
Oh, okay. Well, fuck. I'm just going to do it then at one point. But then, there's a really famous clip of David Lynch where this one guy says, "You have stated before that Eraserhead is your most religious film. Reflect on that." And then David Lynch just goes, "No," right? Like he just he's not going to do it. And I think people really love that clip. They reference that clip often. And so I feel like this masterclass, it's not him giving you practical steps on how to make a movie. It's more about like the feeling of movies. And that's such a David Lynch thing to begin with, is just feeling. Feeling is always discussed with David Lynch, right?
Yes.
And like when I watch this, I'm so used to hearing him in interviews. He's very comfortable doing interviews. He does interviews
Yes.
all the time. He does lectures all the time. And he says stuff similar to what's in this masterclass.
Yeah.
So it's like you're just kind of hearing this person that you've heard over and over again. And you're like, okay, I know where he's going. And it kind of hits differently than if someone else were to say, if anyone else were to say it.
Right. Yeah, David Lynch, I think, is one of those people. I don't know if this is something just me or whatever, but like sometimes I'm in a mood where I just want to hear people talk, and not necessarily like in a podcast way. There's like basically three people that I'll just listen to them talk about anything for any amount of time. And not only does it like relax me, it makes me feel smarter. One is David Lynch. One is James Baldwin, the author and poet, and one is Slavoj Žižek, the philosopher.
Ooh,
Either
wow.
of those guys talking about anything, because you know, like I live in Staten Island, New York, where when a lot of times when people from Staten Island are come up against real intellect, their go-to is sort of like, "Oh, you think you're better than me?" Right? I'm somebody who loves intellect. I don't mind feeling small when I'm talking to somebody. When somebody's truly, truly brilliant, and every single way they see the world is different from how I see it, and they've really thought about it, I think there's nothing more refreshing. But all three of those guys are that way. You know, you could ask, you know, I David Lynch is sadly dead. But like you could ask him about like how do you feel about candy? And I'm sure he has like he'll tell you some story about like buying candy in the 50s and it'll be some great story.
Right. No, yeah. Mike, actually, that made me so happy what you just said, because I've thought recently, who are my three people? I just randomly came up with that number. And who are my three people that kind of fit that mold that I would say are like my people, to where I don't doubt their authenticity?
Yeah.
Like, I can listen to them talk, and I'm like, oh, they're not full of shit. They are just who they are, and I love them, right? And David Lynch is my number one, and then David Bowie, and then there's Grant Morrison, who's a comic book writer, and I just feel like they are authentic. David Lynch and David Bowie are dead, unfortunately. But the crazy part is that, they're all David Lynch and David Bowie are in Fire Walk With Me, right? And
Yes.
Lynch worked with Bowie at that point. That kind of blows my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
you sent me a long interview with Grant Morrison,
Yeah.
which I liked a lot. But then I just recently saw a cool clip of him talking about James Gunn's Superman, where he was saying he thinks it's the best Superman. It's the Superman that feels the most like Superman. The only thing that he doesn't like is what he did to the parents, the Kryptonian parents.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, like with people like that, it's beyond the idea of whether I agree with them or not. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's
There's
just, wow, your point of view is at you, because so many people have points of view that are just, they just reach them for who knows what reason, right?
Yeah.
Smart people like who we're talking about, like they have point of views that are like whether you agree with it or not, like they have reasoning behind it.
Yeah.
And those are people that you like to hear, especially in long form.
Yeah, your Trinity that you picked is more impressive than the Trinity that I picked, or like less generic than what I picked. I know James Baldwin, but I don't even know the third person that you referenced there. But what I would say about each of these people that we're talking about is that they don't seem like normal people. They seem like the exception to the rule. Like everyone else, as far as they go and as wild as their ideas might be, you'll still see these little glimpses of regular humanity and conformity. Like I've never felt that with David Lynch ever. And it's not like he's wild and like David Bowie, where would change his appearance and do all these kind of crazy visual things, and or Grant Morrison, where he says crazy stuff about magic. Like David Lynch is very like middle America, straightforward kind of guy who enjoys talking about Coca-Cola and cookie, and like he's a person to hang out with your grandfather.
He's a boomer. He's absolutely a boomer,
Yeah.
but he's like he's an introspective boomer. Like he is of that world of like men wear suit. I mean, you see it in his films. Like it always I his movies always kind of feel like it's the 50s, no matter what time it's supposed to be. You know, men in suits and things like that. But at the same time, like he kind of is able to see through it in a way where he's not like aggravating the way we think of most boomers as aggravating.
Yes.
Or I mean, maybe you don't see them as aggravating. You see them as often having prejudiced ideas and maybe being a little lucky in terms of their financial lives.
Yes. Well, let me ask you a question. Have you seen every single David Lynch movie?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I know I haven't seen The Elephant Man,
Okay.
and I've seen for a long time I hadn't seen Mulholland Drive, but I caught up and saw it. I saw Straight Story recently as well. It unless there's something I'm totally forgetting, I think it might just be Elephant Man.
Yeah. So like Danny and I right now are covering Twin Peaks: The Return
Ugh,
on
so
the
good.
last attempt, right? And we're about to finish it. This is my second time watching it. So I've seen Twin Peaks. I'm not gonna list everything I've seen, but I'll list the things I haven't seen. And I almost feel like a David Lynch poser. I've not seen Eraserhead. I've not seen The Elephant Man. I've not seen Straight Story, and I haven't seen Inland Empire.
No,
But
neither
then,
have I. Neither have I. So I'm with you on that one.
yeah. So I've seen everything else, and I've seen things multiple times. But like, I feel like my connection to him is really from like Room to Dream, from this masterclass. And then my favorite thing is Twin Peaks Return by him.
Yeah. Yeah. Twin Peaks Returns is incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
And that's the funny thing is like watching it with Danny, and like I don't think Danny likes to get to the level that you and I do in our discussions, where we get like really like philosophical and stuff. I think he likes the cinematic experience. Like he'll like movies that we might kind of dismiss often, right? And I know that he's watching Twin Peaks: The Return right now, and he's kind of like, "What the fuck am I watching?"
Was
And
this your
it's
first time with Return?
no, this is my second time.
Okay. So had you seen Return before Shudder did their 100 best scary movies and they listed one of the episodes on that? You had seen it before that. Okay.
Like I think maybe even on that list, they might even have that scene from Mulholland Drive too, that's behind the diner as well. I can't remember.
I had that on
Like,
my list of, I think, I think we did an episode on jump scares, and I think I had that on my list.
Yeah, it's fucking incredible. But like I think Twin Peaks: The Return might be a good thing for us to kind of connect to this masterclass and David Lynch in general, because watching Twin Peaks: The Return, and this goes back to what you were saying. I kind of wanted to tie this back to what you were saying about him being a boomer,
Yeah.
right? I think a lot of people, when they look at David Lynch from a distance, they say two things basically. They say that his stuff doesn't make sense, and that it's like a dream. They always, always, always reference dreams when they talk about David
Yeah.
Lynch. And then the other thing is that his stuff is like disturbing and upsetting.
Yeah.
And 1,000%, there's disturbing stuff in like everything.
Sure.
Oh, I haven't seen The Straight Man either, so I can't speak for that. But like for everything, there's disturbing moments, right? But watching The Return again, I get much more of a sense of like whimsy and like just fun. You know
Yeah.
what I'm saying? And he's got that as well. And I think people kind of always focus on the dark, disturbing stuff.
I agree. I think there is humor in what he does.
Yeah.
And even his stuff that's scary, I wouldn't I it's well, I'm uneasy categorizing him as a horror filmmaker. You know what I
Right.
mean? Like, I'd say maybe the closest movies he has to horrors are like Fire Walk With Me and Lost Highway.
Yes.
But you know, like Wild at Heart is almost like a comedy, although there's horror, there's scary shit in it. But I think
Right.
he's sort of beyond genre. He I think this is another reason why I'm so attracted to him. He's somebody who has figured out who he is, what he wants, and what he likes. I'm very interested in the idea of pursuing a life that you have created for yourself and tailored to your own beliefs and your own feelings. He has this term that he comes back to a lot here and also a lot in his book, which is the art life. The art life. And he says he lives the art life. His idea of the art life is it something that connects with you?
Yes, I mean, like, I mean, you know, whatever. I don't care, like, you know, if the government's going to get involved in this or anything, or hopefully people that are connected to my job don't hear this. But like, I was high when I watched the Masterclass the second time, right? And like it was a fucking experience. Like it was like almost like a religious experience watching it again, because I feel like this is a person where this guy has such profound thoughts about things and then describes them in such a simple way that it never comes off like he's talking down to anyone. He
Yeah.
never comes off, and the tone of his voice and stuff, the way that he talks, like you want to be like David Lynch. You want to be like David Lynch because he's able to make such compelling work and people ponder it and analyze it and talk about it all the time. But then he's also like a fucking rock star, right? Like you always see
Yes.
him, like when you know, read Room to Dream and you see him in, you know, clips and stuff, he's always with like some super beautiful woman,
He said four
you know?
wives. He refers to them in this, like one of my four wives,
Right. You know,
not at
and
the
you
same
know, he's like,
time over his life.
right. But he was like with Isabella Rossellini, and like no one's gonna sit there and be like, oh, David Lynch, like I'm trying to think of the culturally appropriate word, but like no one's going to like question his sort of like manliness or his like, you know, like if he
Yeah.
went to like a room with a bunch of bikers and stuff, they wouldn't be like, look at this loser. Like they think he's cool. He just like oozes cool, you
Right.
know? And he doesn't fucking try.
Well,
He's
that's, but isn't that what cool really is? I mean, like,
Yes.
really think about it. Like, cool, like, the real definition of being a cool person is somebody who's not, there's no effort towards pretense at all. Right. I mean, it's something we all learn as kids, right? When we try, we're like, I want to be cool. Like, you're in middle school ever. You're like, I want to be cool. And you try to be different things, and it never works to try.
Right.
Cool always comes from just being who you are.
Yes. And David Lynch might be the best example of that that I've ever seen in a
Yeah.
person, you know? So, I mean, like, just kind of bringing it back to this masterclass, he does have this whole section because I like that you brought up violence, because I do remember watching this masterclass the second time, and he does a whole rant about violence in the world. You know, he says, like, the hospitals are full, The jails are full. He's talking about all these horrible things in the world. So, like, he's very aware of it. And what's interesting about his violence in his films is that he'll show you stuff that makes you feel so bad inside, like the way you do when you watch that episode of The Sopranos when Ralphie kills the stripper. You know,
Yes.
like those real, like The Sopranos was very good at having these moments where it was like you just felt like dirty and bad about the world seeing these moments. David Lynch does that, but then he also makes his criminals and these horrible people like buffoonish often, and like it borders on the absurd, right? If we think about like Mulholland Drive, we think about like the hitman that gets hired, and like that scene where he has to kill like three people because he just keeps fucking up. You know, it like it switches like left and right, you know. And I think that we've talked about in a show before, like for a movie to make you have a feeling, I think it's done its job. And that's such an impressive thing to be able to do that. And he's able to convey that feeling of ugliness of violence like very well.
And what's really interesting is he seems to be somebody who in the real world doesn't like violence,
No.
he talks about like put violence and darkness in your art, but it doesn't have to be in your life. And he really pushes back against the romantic notion of artists have to be these moody, maudlin, brooding people. And he, which is something I really have always believed too. Like he says like negativity is the antithesis of creativity. Negativity like squeezes the creativity. He says something like it squeezes the creative tube closed or something like that. And he even says like, everyone gives the example of Van Gogh, but yes, Van Gogh is miserable, but when he was painting, that was probably the only joy he experienced. You need to have the negativity out of your mind to create. And I think that's, I so identify with that because, like, just in my life, I have anxiety, I have depression, I have OCD, I take medication for these things, and I meditate, and I try to live a life that helps me. But when I'm having, like, a depressive day or a depressive time or an anxious time, the ideas don't flow. But, like, when I don't want to say happy because that sounds like smiley happy, but like when I don't have that, well, when like my heart and mind are open and I'm not feeling stressed, that's when like I get an idea for a podcast. That's where like, like novel ideas. Like when you're worried about something, you can't have these novel ideas. And he talks about the art life because he's an artist. And so he relates it to that. But his definition of the art life, I think, is something that anyone could live. He sees it as devoting your life towards something, anything. Find a thing, devote your life toward it. And to him, the highest meaning you could achieve as a person is by doing it. But he doesn't mean it in a capitalism work kind of way. He means it in if to you it's painting, it's painting. If to you it is business, then it's business. But if to you, if it has nothing to do with how you make money to live, he goes, that's fine. That's separate. That's not your work, right? There's work and then your work, right? You might work, my favorite example, he doesn't bring this up, but my favorite example, because I read about this, it blew my mind when I read about this. And I might have talked about this on the show. I might have even talked about it with you. But the poet T.S. Eliot, he worked at a bank for most of his career. But he was a published poet. He was well known. He made money, but he liked getting up. He liked going to the bank. He liked wearing a suit. He liked his office. Everyone at the bank knew that he was a poet, and he lived his whole life doing that. It was separate from who he was, but he also liked it. Like when I was younger, I spent a lot of time like, oh, I don't want to have a real job. I want to just be creative. And, I feel like in his way of thinking, like I feel like I live the art life, but I'm not an artist. I mean, I'm creative in terms of the podcast, which I put a lot of effort into, and then my real job is social work and in human services, which to me feels connected to art, even though it's not art. Because it's,
Right.
I think of it as a net positive for the world.
Right.
Every day I at least go, I haven't made the world worse today. But I feel like I understand his idea of the art life. Like, I don't get paid for this podcast. No one even listens to it. But I'm dedicated. This is the thing that it's this perfect expression of me. And I
Yeah.
have my little setup. Like he talks about a setup. You need your tools and you need your space and you need to curate the environment around you. And
Yes.
that gives you meaning.
Yes, absolutely. And when he talks about making money from films, he doesn't talk about it like, oh, we made a lot of money, and he like takes pride in it. He doesn't talk about, he actually doesn't brag about his work like ever, really. He doesn't talk about like, oh, this influenced this or this influenced this movie.
Yeah.
He doesn't do that. When he talks about making money or being successful, it's to finance what's next. Like he does that in Room to Dream. He does that in this masterclass a little bit, but it's all about like just being able to keep creating,
Yeah.
right? And what's interesting about David Lynch is, besides film, he was passionate about many things, but he was passionate about meditation. And you mentioned that you meditate before. I also meditate, not as much as I'd like to, and I did every day for a while. But David Lynch was very, very much into meditation. And one thing that's a
Yeah.
major part of Room to Dream, and then also this masterclass, this is actually what the masterclass starts off with, is the concept that ideas aren't something that you're like building inside yourself, you're trying to make, which I think a lot of people that are creative that are in these various industries, novel writing, filmmaking, you know, musicians, whatever, he's talking about the idea that like you get an idea from your subconsciousness, and by focusing on the idea itself, it becomes more and more tangible. He does this really excellent metaphor where he compares it to going fishing.
Yeah.
And he says that you pull the fish out of the water, and then when it's out of the water and you look at it more closely, then you see the details like the scales of the fish. And he said that that's sort of the key to making something creative. So that notion in itself is getting rid of the ego, you know, which
Yes.
has to do with meditation. His specific form of meditation that he was into was transcendental meditation. And I know that that comes from the idea that like we're all one, and we're not just like this one, you know, individual ego self. And so to think that like your ideas come from somewhere beyond you is very humble, I think.
The way that I thought about it when I was watching this was that he's an auteur without an ego. Like
Yep.
the auteur filmmaker is typically like a person who they steer the ship of the film, and the film is how they want it to look, sound, whatever. And there's also this idea of like there's a sort of toxic masculine idea too behind auteur filmmaking of like, I'm the boss, I'm the leader, everyone serves me. Whereas he does have total control over his films, but
Yeah.
it's all in this idea of serving an idea, and he really treats the ideas as external. He does.
Yeah.
He almost has no ownership over his own ideas, which, by the way, may be why he can't explain them to people, right?
Yeah.
Like,
Right.
there's part of, it could just be like it. And it seems to me that he thinks a lot in images. I think when he talks specifically about catching ideas for him, I think it's like he gets an idea like the lady behind the dumpster that looks like she's made of garbage or something like that. I think that's just my guess on how he caught ideas.
Yeah.
And then I think he gets it and he doesn't go, where's that come from or what does it mean? He just gets it and goes, okay, that's the idea. Let me write it down so I don't forget
Yeah.
it. And then let me try to make it into the film. So it's almost like he doesn't know really.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fascinating, like you said, egoless way of thinking about it.
I saw a clip of him because, you know, obviously our algorithms just feed us what we're into, and I'm obviously into him. And so it was an interview with him, and he was talking about how with an idea, it's also like a puzzle piece. And he takes that one individual puzzle piece and tries to imagine what the remainder of the puzzle is versus like trying to find the pieces to make it fit. Like he ponders that one piece. And when you go to talk to David Lynch about people like that's why I enjoy talking to you, because like I think you know more about David Lynch than I do, even though I'm a huge David Lynch fan. And then like a lot of people that I talk to, they're kind of like, oh, here he goes, talk about fucking David Lynch again. Because like you try to explain these things to them and it has depth to you, it affects you, but like you don't really know how to fucking explain it correctly. Like, no, this means this, or like this feels special, you know? Like, I think if you don't mind, I kind of wanted to talk about things that he does that are different from your standard expectation of what a movie's supposed to be like.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm going to list a couple, and I'd like you to maybe list a couple as well. But like, I think first of all, his editing between scenes is very different from films, where he'll start a scene and it could be like in the middle of a scene and it doesn't necessarily make sense in the context of it. And then he'll cut away to another scene and then come back to the previous one. And even though hours or days might have passed in other scenes, if he goes back to a previous scene, it might still be in that same moment,
right?
Which is like jarring unto itself, right? Because you expect film to go in a linear way. You expect sort of time to be moving, you know, at the same time in each scene. But he doesn't do that. Then another thing is characters will have over-the-top, ridiculous reactions to things.
It often
follows like a quietness where it's almost like they're delayed and then someone said, go, and then they have this crazy reaction to something, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many things. Like, what could you add to that list?
Of things that are unique to his sort of film perspective?
Yeah, like things that like he does. Like, I mean, I see it all the time. I see all these things where I'm like, yeah, this nobody else does this shit. But it's funny, too, because nowadays I actually do see other filmmakers where I'm like, oh, they like David Lynch.
Sure, yeah.
You know, but before we talk about that, why don't you list some of the things that you think he does or that you've seen him do that you're like, oh, this is not... It goes against the expectations.
Well, what I think there's a couple things in terms of his uniqueness. I think he truly is a capital A artist who started working in film. Like, he started in painting and sculpture. He wanted to be a painter. And then he just had this idea of a moving painting. And then so he started experimenting with film. And then he got into film. Like, he wasn't like a film... He obviously knows a lot about films, but he wasn't like a kid that was like, I want to grow up and make movies. Like, he somehow got to movies in the circuitous way. So I think he always approaches it as an artist. To me, that stands out for him is like, what really makes him different is that I think the very form of film, narrative film, is there's an interesting dichotomy to it, which is films are these Frankenstein things that are all these disparate pieces that you sew together. And narrative is sort of the suture that holds it together, right? Like, if I wanted to film you coming through a door, right, and then coming into a different room, I might film you opening the door from one side on one day, but then the next day we film it and I say, come back and wear the same clothing, and I try to make the lighting match. And then when I put it together in a film, the narrative flows. Like, you don't even see the editing. The editing becomes invisible because you are just watching the narrative. The narrative is suturing over all these cuts that are in the film, right? I mean, like, these aren't my ideas, but a film has all these edits in it, which should bring us out of it, but it doesn't usually, because Hollywood and narrative filmmaking has gotten really good at focusing on story and story elements, and that grounds us in something. I think where he's different is he doesn't feel any fidelity to keeping up the illusion. This isn't reality. I mean, look, people refer to his movies as dreamlike, but you know, one of the easiest cliche things about all films is to compare it to dreams. And they are like dreams, and it's because they're like dreams. They're like dreams in that they're not real, but they look real and feel
Right.
real. But when you look at them close enough, it's very clear that they're not real, but it's easy to be fooled into thinking they're real.
Yes,
And I think that's what's interesting to him. Even when he's making a narrative film, he doesn't spoon feed you anything. He doesn't
no.
seem to be interested in keeping up an illusion for you. And he doesn't care about like straight up just breaking your satisfaction. I mean, like Mulholland Drive, spoiler alert, I guess. I mean, but like it kind of ends with it's not a dream, but it kind of ends like it didn't matter what happened. Like you might have been
Yeah.
waiting for an answer, but it doesn't, what does it matter? None of this is real anyway.
Right.
Same thing
Right.
with like the way Twin Peaks Returns ends.
Yeah.
So I think that's what makes him different. That's a long-winded way of saying I think he doesn't care about the reality of the false reality of cinema, of making you believe the illusion. He's more interested in showing, making you think of it as an illusion.
Right. And I mean, that goes back to his whole thing of not giving explanations for stuff, right? Because,
Yeah.
like, when you look at art in a gallery, right, you mentioned his painter background, and then him wanting to make a living painting or a moving painting is what led to him making Eraserhead. When you go to look at an art gallery, it's not like our media that you and I talk about on this show or that I talk about on my channels, where it's like you have to think about this lore and you have to have the explanation for all these things and you have to make sure that you hit these story beats because of all, he doesn't give a shit about any of that
Yeah.
whatsoever. But he works with people that do. And like Mark Frost, who worked with him on Twin Peaks,
Yeah.
like he's very different from David Lynch to where like you look at a scene, like I think of like the madness of this one scene in Fire Walk With Me, where you have Laura Palmer and Leland Palmer and they're in a car
Oh,
and
yes.
the light, right? And Leland is like revving the engine, and Mike, the one-armed man, is in a car yelling at Leland, and he's saying, "You stole my corn." And it's just like insanity, right? It's just like you're like, "What the fuck is going on?" Right? Now, there's so many people that are David Lynch fans, and they like know so much about the behind-the-scenes stuff. The corn is Gorgonzola, or whatever they say in.
Arben Boja, I think.
Right. And it's like supposed to represent pain and suffering. And Mike is supposed to be inhabited by the little guy, the arm,
Yeah.
and Leland is inhabited by Bob. So on a narrative sense, it like does make sense, even though it looks like madness. It's essentially like a spirit in a guy
Yeah.
yelling at a guy who has a spirit in his body, you know. And David Lynch does it in such a like the fact that he's not holding your hand and explaining things, and he never explains it ever.
Yeah.
It's not like there's that moment at the end of the movie where it all gets like, and the reason why he was yelling at him is because of this. There's no
Yeah.
moment like that, you know? And I think that that's actually the allure. Because I
Yeah.
say this all the time, you probably get sick of me fucking saying this, but like, I hate exposition in movies. And David Lynch is like the opposite of exposition. There's like
Right.
no explanation for anything.
There is one, wait, but there is one moment that he gives exposition after like 35 years, and it blew my mind. There was one
Oh.
episode in Twin Peaks: The Returns where in like 5 minutes he affirms every fan theory from the last 30 years and everyone's mind explodes. He's talking to the younger FBI agent. He's like, "We're part of a team called Blue Rose, and they're basically like X-Files. We investigate things, and we thought there was something supernatural about Laura Palmer's death." And I remember watching it and other fans being like, we all were online, like, I can't believe every fan theory we've all had for all this time. He, like, a character just said it. And it was coming out of David Lynch's character's mouth, too. He just said it. But you're right. That's really an outlier. He doesn't care. And I think Mark Frost is the guy who's like the more traditional guy who, that's where they're a good team, because Frost tries to bring it into some kind of concrete thing. Like he talks in the masterclass about how he created Bob, which is a story he tells a lot, which is they're filming in Laura Palmer's bedroom, and the Frank Silva, who was just like a production, he was working on the production, I forget what it was. maybe production designer or something, and he like got stuck. He kind of like he was moving furniture around. He got stuck in a corner, and then Lynch, and he's in the past class. He's talking about even when you're making the movie, keep your mind open to ideas. And he said that like I just saw him, and I had this idea, and I ran up to him and was like, I want you to be in this shot where,
Yep.
and talk about a great jump scare. Like when you see the we're showing Laura Palmer's room, but at the foot of her bed, you're just crouching at the foot of her bed looking up, which is like everyone's had a nightmare like that, right? Where someone is standing near your bed looking at you. And it was just
Yep.
because he thought he looked interesting and he got the idea. And then it's on, Mark Frost, the other writer, is the one who goes, okay, shit, then who is this guy? And then it becomes
Right.
this whole lore. But it
Right.
really started with he just thought he looked interesting. And then there
Right.
was another shot of the mother where the guy by accident was caught in the mirror, and he was like, oh wow, like he again it goes back to like it's from the ether, it's out there. He's
Right.
like he felt like the world was telling him that this guy had to be part of the story.
It 1000%. I mean, when you think of Twin Peaks, probably your first thing you're going to think of is Agent Cooper. You'll think of Laura Palmer. Maybe you think about them equally. Then Bob is like the next thing that you associate with Twin Peaks. And this is a guy that was just on set working with the production design, and David Lynch just absorbed him into it. Like that's why like discussing Twin Peaks: The Return can be difficult with Danny, because I know that there's stuff that like they truly thought out, and they're like, this represents this idea, this represents this happening. And I know there's stuff where David Lynch just got inspired on the set, and it's like there's no real explanation. It's just that's what happened that day,
With
you
the
know?
room to dream, right? It's the room to dream. There's a famous reel or TikTok. You've probably seen it online. Well, I mean, maybe not. Maybe it's just because it's in my algorithm. But there's this famous clip that goes around of him flipping. David Lynch, despite how like nice he also was curmudgeonly. And if you got in the way of his work, he would flip out. So there's two distinct moments. One is he's shooting something and a producer, I think someone from Showtime, because he had a really hard time with Showtime, who he did Twin Peaks Return for. She was like, maybe we can cut this down. And he's like, what the fuck? What do you mean cut this down? Who gives a shit how long a fucking scene is? Holy moly, I can't fucking work like this.
Right.
And
Right.
he flips out because but it just shows his thinking compared to theirs. Like she's like, the scene's a little too long. He's like, why? Who gives a shit? And then the other one is it's a production meeting where they're going over the schedule for the next week, and they only have one morning to work in Truman's office. It's not Truman in The Return. It's Robert Forrester's character,
Right.
and he's like, why do we only have one morning? And they're like, well, we have to do this. And he's like, I that doesn't give me. He's like, I love that place. That gives me room to dream. I could have dreamed up all kinds of fun ideas. Now we got to rush through it. He doesn't want to rush. He
Right.
wants to. I mean, and that's crazy because movies are really hard to make. The idea that he wants enough looseness that he could just come up with a shot, just come up with an idea, and just. I mean, that's amazing.
Yes.
And
Yes. And I mean,
it's always fun to hear him yell at some,
oh yeah, right. Because it does seem out of character. Yeah. But that's why this masterclass, in a lot of ways, I could kind of feel like it was a scam. I've only seen three masterclasses, and one was this one, another one was Neil Gaiman's, and this is before we knew he was a fucking predator.
Me
And then
too,
I bought Masterclass again because of the Duffer Brothers, because like I was excited about Stranger Things when it came back before it went off the deep end at the end there.
yeah.
But I was watching their Masterclass, and even the Neil Gaiman one, there isn't that feeling like you're in a class and they're giving you specific instruction on how to do things, just like this David Lynch one. And it could kind of feel like a scam. But then there's this one part where he talks about index cards. And I wanted to know what you thought about that, because like to me, that feels like one of the most practical, hey, do this thing to make a movie. And I grapple with that, because I'm guessing that 70 scenes, that sort of a typical runtime for a movie
But
is
he
probably.
doesn't even say that, Peter. He says 70 ideas.
Oh.
Honestly, this masterclass doesn't tell you how to make a movie. It tells you how to make a David Lynch movie, right?
Yeah.
And that's fine. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? But
Right.
like, I don't even know what he means by ideas.
Right.
But he says that he goes, when you get an idea around the story, you put it on an index card, and when you have 70 index cards, you have 70 ideas, you've got a movie. I
Right.
don't know if that's true for other filmmakers. It's him.
Right.
yeah. Well, I would tell you my history with it, which is right at the beginning of the COVID pandemic and the lockdown, I was very lucky that I didn't lose my job, but my specific role was not necessary because my job was I went out and helped people in the
Yeah.
field. I helped people with disabilities get jobs. So no one was working. So I was lucky that they kept me on, but they had me do something else in the company. And I really didn't have much to do. It was really boring. But again, I was very, very lucky that they didn't let me go or
Right.
furlough me or fire me or whatever.
Right.
But I had nothing to do. And remember the pandemic, some of us were trying to learn how to bake bread. Some of us were doing Animal Crossing. We all were trying to cope. So my thing was Masterclass. I bought Masterclass and I watched a good number of them.
Yeah.
And it's funny, if I had to think of the opposite of this one, R.L.
Yeah.
Stine has a Masterclass, and his creative process couldn't be less, and God bless him, whatever. It couldn't be less authentic than Lynch's. He's like, you come up with a spooky title first. And also R.L. Stine, a lot of his Goosebumps shit is ghostwritten, which he doesn't ever mention. So, he doesn't mention that in his masterclass. Like, you come up with an idea and then you pay a 25-year-old to write it for you.
Right.
But I watched a bunch of them, is my point. I watched a bunch of them, but this is the one that really sticks with me.
Yeah. Well, it's just because you want to spend as much time with David Lynch as you can, and I kind of dreamed of meeting him one day, when I really got into him. I was like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if like somehow I could meet him? And they even have a David Lynch screenwriting school where
Yeah.
you can pay a crazy amount of money and do his screenwriting school, and it still exists even after his death. I feel like David Lynch is more like an inspiration versus someone that you could get practical like advice from.
For
And that's
sure.
why, like, ultimately, I enjoyed the class, but like, if I felt like I was going to learn a lot about filmmaking, I would have felt like I had been cheated of money.
Oh,
I
yeah.
think, like, truly, the only way that you could learn from David Lynch was if you like worked with him directly, like one-on-one.
The only advice that he gives that I feel is actual practical if you want to be a director is
Yeah.
he talks, there is a section where he talks about working with actors, and he says, don't be a bully, be kind to them, know that it takes bravery to go for these big ideas. He actually sounded like a very kind director when it came to the actors.
Yeah.
And he tried to make them feel comfortable and good. And he goes, like, you're just trying to get them to catch the idea that you have, so you both have it. Which again goes very against that ego, maniacal, toxic director thing of, being an asshole like Stanley Kubrick to Shelley Duvall. He seems
Right.
to really be like, and he uses the same people over and over and over again. Laura Dern, he used forever. David, not David, what's his name? Kyle
Kyle.
MacLachlan. He used over and over again. And
Yeah.
Kyle, people will ask Kyle MacLachlan, do you know what this shit's about? And he'd be like, no, but it doesn't really matter. Like, David will talk to me and I'll get what he's trying to get for me and then I'll do it.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very good. And again, I think what's valuable to me is regular life advice. Like, he talks about, like, fear and negativity is bad, right? So if you're working with somebody, why torture them? Why be a dick to them? And I'm a supervisor at my job, and I also teach, and I've taught for a long time, and I feel like that's something I truly believe in. Like, I'm not a boss.
Right.
I just don't work that. First of all, I don't want to live in that negative space. I don't wanna. Anytime I have to be, in some way like heavy, I always am like almost resentful. Like, why are you making me be a boss? But for the most part, I like to think of like more like leadership and It's the same in the classroom. And like, why be negative? Like, negative isn't gonna get us anywhere. Like the most I'll ever say to, like, when there's really a problem with someone who's on my team, I'll say to them, like, I want to make this better. Do you want to make it better? Can we make it better together? Can we f get past this issue that we're having and find the answer? Like, to me, that's how I approach it. So I
Yeah.
really, again, I like really identified with what he was saying, which is like, what's the point of being a taskmaster? I mean, we've all had shitty bosses, right? The worst bosses are the people that out of their own insecurity or out of their own fear, they make everyone else feel afraid and toxic, and nothing really gets done. You know, look, I
Right.
mean, like, we've all had, like, and when we were all in school, right, there was the teacher that would yell like crazy and would have a hoarse voice. And that teacher, really, the minute she started yelling or he started yelling, they lost all respect for the kids,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You can't yell. You can't give in to that. You have to communicate. So anyway, again, I'm being very long-winded today because I'm thinking of Lynch, but that's the way that I approach working with people, and I think that's probably the most practical thing he says.
It's a really great point, and he does seem to have like all the women that have worked with him seem to like love him very much, you know.
Yeah.
He worked with Naomi Watts a lot towards the end of his career,
Yeah.
and like I think that he just saw her and he cast her in the film of
Yeah.
Mulholland Drive. Like he didn't even have her audition; he just knew she was the right one. Like he has a lot of moments like that, and he seems very beloved. You know,
He
when
follows
I
his
think,
intuition. He's really a believer in intuition.
right, and it's funny because like. You know, I already mentioned this, but I watched the Masterclass again when I was high, and like there's this whole section of the Masterclass where he is talking about other films, and they cut to like a screen, and it's like him watching the movies, and he's watching It's a Wonderful Life.
Any
He's watching what do you call it? What's the one?
Sunset Boulevard,
Sunset
which
Boulevard.
Mulholland Drive takes a lot from Sunset Boulevard.
Right, exactly. And like there's things like characters in Twin Peaks, like they have names that are like based on Hitchcock characters and stuff like
Yeah.
Vertigo, right? Gordon Cole, I think, is like that's two different filmmakers' names or actors' names, whatever. Like his love for movies is like ridiculous. And I think that sometimes people don't realize that some of his weird scenes in movies or some of the things that don't make sense narratively are just homages to other movies. Like he's wanting to
Right.
homage a movie, but like I have a difficult time going back and watching a movie like It's a Wonderful Life, but then like watching David Lynch talk about it, I was like,
I'd
this
start
is
crying.
fucking I was like, this is fucking amazing, you
Yeah.
know?
And also, there's a very well documented love that he has for The Wizard of Oz, which feels counterintuitive because you look at David Lynch's films and The Wizard of Oz, and you think, you know what, these things couldn't be more different. But he's so enamored with The Wizard of Oz, and he talks about this thing has made us dream for decades. And he puts Wizard of Oz homages in his films. Probably the most like direct one is he puts
Wild at Heart.
Glinda the Good Witch in Wild at Heart, where it was
Right.
based on a book, and she's not in the book. But beyond that, there's Wizard of Ozzy shit. I mean, episode 8 of The Return, the black and white episode, that's got Wizard of Oz. Like, it's actually having a real direct effect on him.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, he's not regurgitating it in any way.
No. I mean, everything of his is original. There's never this sense of, you know, he's trying to go for a specific style or trying to appease a certain fan. It's just completely like him just taking ideas that he thinks are beyond him and then making it into a movie, you know? And a lot of
Yeah.
people can't like wrap their heads around it. And I think it, you know, they just kind of dismiss it. But if you're willing to believe that like everything he's doing is with intention, then it's just like it's like one of the most enjoyable experiences you can
Yes, I agree.
have.
And I think if you it, it I think the average like regular filmmaker, the average regular film goer, they think of a film as narrative and telling a story, and they want that. But I think if you could just give that up a little bit, you could
Yeah.
find great pleasure in his stuff. A couple last things, and then we'll wrap it up. He talks about daydreaming, and he says daydreaming is a state of mind that helps you catch ideas. And he talks about you should daydream every day. And someone else that's really brilliant, George Carlin,
Oh,
has
yes.
also said the same thing, the exact
Yeah.
same sentiment, we should all daydream every day. And I'm just wondering, do you agree with that? Do you try to daydream?
Yes. Some more people that I should have added to my list are George Carlin, 1,000%, and then Jason Pargan, who's the author of John Dies at the End,
Yeah.
and kind of more of a TikTok personality nowadays than a
But he was on
YouTube.
Cracked, right? What did he do? Cracked podcast?
He is a writer and he puts out novels, but like his main thing is like people know him from TikTok and YouTube now, right? And he does these little short videos, and he was talking about the importance of boredom, right? He was saying how like boredom is what has led to so many different things, and it's because people were just bored out of their minds and they had to focus. And our society that we have now, we almost live in a boredomless society where it's like you could
So
immediately occupy your attention. It like you actually have to work to not occupy your attention now. Like there
what?
isn't even a possibility of boredom. And I think that I 1,000% agree with it. Like when I try to force myself to write within the middle of my life, daily life, it is very difficult. But if I have a day where I have more free time, I was able to go for a walk. Maybe if I chose not to listen to something while I was driving, then I might have some sort of deeper thoughts and come up with some more creative ideas. But otherwise, I'm like completely deprived of them if I'm going through my everyday experience.
See, I find that, I mean, I don't have children like you, so I probably have less to do, but I find that if I could turn off the worry, turn off the, oh, I gotta do this tomorrow. Oh, did I do that right? Oh, am I gonna get in trouble for that? Oh, am I sick? What's this? What's that? Did I bite my tongue or do I have tongue cancer? Well, let me Google. Let me Google. If I could turn that off, it'll come. Even for a minute while walking to the bathroom, or even for a minute, doing something else. So I don't have like a dedicated time to daydream, but if I could turn off the worry machine,
Yeah.
stuff comes. Stuff
Yeah.
does come.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's why Lynch, I mean, it just makes so much sense that meditation was so important to him because he would like that's what meditation is all about, is turning off the thoughts.
So I'd like to end this episode by getting kind of meta, but I actually think this will be interesting.
Okay.
You write and you also do two podcasts. I do this podcast. And I'm kind of interested in your creative process.
Okay.
And I'd like to talk about my creative, because I'm actually in right now, I'm in a phase of trying to change my creative process.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
So like how like wh whichever one you want to talk about, writing or podcasting, like
Sure.
what's your process?
Okay. Thank you. That's an awesome question to be given. My YouTube creative process is not really even worth talking about because essentially it's just getting together with my friends, like I get together with you and talking about whatever we would normally talk about that's out currently, right? And if there isn't anything out currently, then we look up stuff that's related and we're like, oh, we can talk about this. This came out a couple of years ago. So it's not really worthy to discuss that. But as far as writing goes, for me, like what I have to do is I have to sit down with the computer on my lap or on a table and just start writing, because otherwise I will just continue to like world build and make notes on the story versus sitting down and actually writing the story. So like and then the weirdest part, and this might be worthy of a podcast or it might be interesting to people, is the weirdest part is I have so many fucking ideas. I have worlds of ideas, like a shared universe of ideas in my head going back over 20 years. But when I go to write, I can't write any of them out. Like I just freeze up. And I equate it to like when you're at a bar with your friends and you're wanting to go get with a girl, or you know, if it's a girl, get with a guy or whatever, and you see this attractive person and then you freeze up versus going up and talking to them. That's the feeling I get. So I have to write, and then when I do write, it's something that's completely unrelated to any of the ideas I have going on in my head. And then what I end up writing gives birth to new things, you know? So the key thing for me is I have to just sit down and write and not fuck around, and then I have to keep going with what I'm working on. And often my problem is that I don't finish the thing that I'm working on. So what about you, my man? Tell me.
So for PCMC, I have a master list of episode ideas that I've had since the beginning 8 years ago. And there are some ideas that are on there that we have never gotten to. And then there are some ideas that'll be on for a week, and then we'll do it and it'll be off, because I do remove them when we do it. But it does begin to build, and there's also, since Halloween's such a big thing for my show, there's a sort of second section on the list of just Halloween ideas. The reason I'm trying to change it is because I used to put too much effort, and not that you should put too much effort, I used to put too much anxious effort into it. So like what this David Lynch, right? So like what I used to do is like I would watch this David Lynch thing twice. I would watch it once, and then I would watch it again, and I would take notes, and I would type the notes out on my phone. And that's a really arduous process. And I take copious notes. Like in every episode, I've never done an episode without notes. I've never done an episode where I was just like, yeah, I got it in my head and I do it, except for the Scream episodes, because we usually come right from the theater to do it. So there's always notes, and I take more notes than I ever say. I just want to have it written down. And then recently I was oh so then we record I then I record we record two at a time, and then I have 1 week where I edit the two episodes, and then a week where I'm preparing for the next recording, and I'm always like two or three recordings ahead in terms of what's booked. So like right now I've booked the guest slash co-host that will be like three ahead of us right now. And I just got to a point recently where I kind of felt burnt out by it. And I was like, I had to step back and go like, wait, okay, PCMC should be fun. And I realized like I had slipped into a very anxious mindset about it. And I had to say to myself, number one, I don't have to prove myself to anybody. Like, this isn't a class. Like, it's a podcast. I'm reacting to things. Like, I don't have to prove that I'm smart to people, right? So I don't have to take all these crazy notes like I'm writing a dissertation. And then also, I said, you know, like I have this anxiety about forgetting things. And I was like, you know what? I don't have to watch everything twice. That's crazy. Like, I can watch something and take notes. And then I started taking notes, dictating it to my phone. So like I'll pause and then say a note into my phone rather than type it, which has saved me a lot of time. So I'm trying to approach the whole creative process of PCMC with a much easier hand than I have. And also I said to myself, you know, like if we do an episode on David Lynch Masterclass, this doesn't have to be the be all end all exhaustive word on that. It could be just this is me and my friend's reaction to that. There could be things that aren't said or don't come up. So I'm trying to make it less of a stressful thing. And I know why it became stressful, because one, I'm an anxious person, and two, I care about PCMC a lot. But I'm actively trying to pull back a little bit. And another thing I've been trying to do is probably because I have so much of my education and my teaching experiences in cinema, I've been saying, you know what, like I want to start reacting to things I don't know about. So I've been trying to do less movie episodes. There's always going to be a big part of PCMC that's movie related, but I've been trying to with you and the other co-hosts and stuff, like, be like, what are some ideas that aren't movies? And like this idea, I wouldn't have done this 3 years ago. I would have been like, oh, a master class, does that really count as something? You know,
Yeah.
but like, we're doing it, and I've got some other really experimental episodes coming up. So I found I had to like go easier with the way I approach it to find the fun again. And like Lynch says, without that negativity, I'm enjoying PCMC a lot again.
Yeah. That so okay, what you just brought up is very interesting on two different levels, right? Because
Because
on
no
one
one
level,
listens to this podcast, so who could possibly care about anything I'm saying?
right, well, okay, but that is a worthy, that's a thing to consider, right? Is like if no one's listening, does it even matter if you're trying to appeal to the audience, right? Which that happens, like comic books transformed, I'm lucky if I get 19 fucking views on YouTube, right? And so anyway, my point I'm trying to make though is that I actually do think that taking copious notes and rewatching things twice is a valuable thing because you do want to have a structure to your conversation, not in the sense of wanting to prove that you're intelligent, but just it like trims the fat. Like one of the things that happens with the videos that I make that there's like almost no effort put into them whatsoever, which is the majority of them these days. There's a lot of sort of like meandering and talking about stuff that is not related to the subject. And I feel like the subject itself, like if you have key points and you've written them out, then you know to get to them, right? Then on the other hand, though, it does, it's much better when it's like a natural conversation between two people versus you're trying to force certain points in, right?
Which I think is a problem, at least with me, with over preparing. Because I'm
Yeah.
looking at my notes like, I got to get to this, I got to get to that. And it's like,
Right.
no.
Right. And what I've noticed just from working with my co-hosts is that like, you know, they don't necessarily go at the pace that I go at myself. And so they might go in a totally different direction. And then I have to really stretch to bring it to what I want to talk about. And it's not natural, you know. And I think that like what are people trying to get from listening to a podcast in the first place? To me, it's like it's basically the equivalent of hanging out with your friends after you've seen a movie and you're talking about the movie and you get excited when a friend brings up a point that you thought. You're like, oh, I feel like that's what a podcast is. It's like they're talking, you're obviously they're talking about something you're interested in. Like if you're watching something that you don't really know a lot about, then you're gonna hope that they do have comprehensive notes because then they're gonna teach you something. But I think that the type of stuff that we make, it's more just like, yeah, he mentioned that, or I thought that was funny too. You know, like that's what you're tuning in to listen to.
Well, I think what I have to do is do more like when I teach, which is I have to have the intellectual confidence. Like I'll make notes when I teach, but then typically I'll just go and I'll react to the students. And I've got to do that more with the podcast. 'Cause like if I like when I'm watching something, if I have a notion about it, instead of writing it down in full and mapping out this idea so then I could just prepackaged put it on the show, I kind of want to put just a kernel down as a note so I could tease it out with the person on it. I want to have more genuine reactions to things on the show. And I
Yes.
should say that we do have listeners, and some of them like are really kind to like reach out to me and stuff. So I don't want to like diminish you. I'm just kind of being self-effacing. I just mean the show's not popular. It's by
Yeah.
no means popular, but there are people that listen, and I'm so happy that they are. I totally get what you're saying. No preparation is bad. No
No.
preparation is very bad. So there's always going to be prep, but I'm keeping myself from over-prepping.
Yes, yeah. And you're essentially doing what David Lynch would encourage, right? Which is giving yourself room to dream, right? Like you have the idea, but you're given the space for something to spring forth from it.
Peter, when you and I were younger in our 20s, many, many, many ages ago, you were not a smoker, but I remember when we would drink, I was a smoker, and when we would drink, sometimes you'd bum a cigarette off me. Were you ever like a smoker? Do you ever now smoke a cigarette?
I vape like
You
there's no
vape.
tomorrow.
Vape lays
You
with them.
know.
Okay. I only ask because Lynch is a famously dedicated smoker and he died of lung cancer and he was kind of fine with it. He kind of knew that was the deal.
Yes, yeah, I think he had emphysema, right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, no, emphysema. That's what it was. But smoking got him.
No, he said this thing of like, I've enjoyed, cigarettes my whole life, and it's with great sadness that I can't enjoy them anymore, and like I understood what he was getting at. Like, it's bad for you. Every time you put it to your fucking lips, you're killing yourself. But there's like a joy that comes from it. And I wish I could kill my addiction to vaping. It's actually something that I've just started in the past like 2.5 years. I did smoke a bit between like 16 to 26, but then I stopped when my daughter was born. And then recently I started vaping. But I mean, yeah, David Lynch, like himself, like I think when people see imagery of him, it's his amazing hair that he had his entire life, and then him like smoking a cigarette.
And he was a he really had he saw great value in things like that. You know, like David Lynch smoked and he drank milkshakes and he loved coffee and he loved things like that. He saw them as very, again, it's his very unique perspective. Even watching him smoke, it's like he's loving that cigarette. He loves it.
That was actually one of my favorite parts of the master class, is just seeing him holding a cigarette while he's like watching a Frank Kafka, Capra movie,
None of this vaping bullshit. Fucking smoke up. And it looked like he had a pack of Newports. And I never imagined him as a Newport man.
I figured he'd have something classy and it would be like in one of those cases, the cases.
Well, on that note, smoke them if you got them. Peter, thank you so much for being here. This is PCMC Pop Culture Man Children. We come out every Wednesday at 5 a.m. We come out every Wednesday, 5 a.m. Or at least 5 a.m. Where I am. And what's going on with your podcasts?
Right now, Danny and I are covering Monarch. It just sounds so lame after everything we just said about David Lynch, but like we're covering Monarch: Legacy of Monsters, which is like connected to the Godzilla movies that are out now, the Kong movies. That's on Apple TV. We're covering that. We are just wrapping up our Twin Peaks: The Return discussion, so it'll be episodes 10 through 18. Gonna record that tomorrow.
So how did you break that down? You did how many at a time?
Danny just cut it in half. He did for it's,
Oh,
there's 18 episodes, so it's 9 and 9.
okay.
And then on Comic Books Transform, there's a little break, but then there's actually a lot of stuff coming out soon. There's the fourth season of Invincible, and then there's the final season of The Boys. Those are
Okay.
both on Amazon, and we're going to cover those. So I mean, there's always stuff to review on both channels, and I think eventually Danny and I might cover In the Mouth of Madness too. I think he on the LasserCast.
Nice.
He just watched that recently too.
Very nice. We end every episode by saying,
Go bye bye.